the heater would not turn off, which even in January makes for a warm trip in Los Angeles. Grigore is just back from the field. He's done some recent work in Romania and Bulgaria, connected with the recent elections there, doing surveys of voters around the election time. And so we're interested to hear what he has to say about the elections in those countries, how they compare, why people vote as they do. So.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I'll start by standing up, and as depending on how exhausted I get, maybe I could sit down after a while. Thanks for coming, first of all. And what I'm going to try to talk about today is, it's actually sort of a second project of mine. My dissertation work was on IMF programs in Eastern Europe and Latin America, but all along I've had this sort of this interest in party politics in Eastern Europe. And much of it goes back to the Romanian elections of 2000, when an extreme right candidate for the presidency got almost a third of the votes. And I started wondering whether Romanians had just turned into fascists overnight or what was going on. And in the process, I started doing more work, both looking at cross-national trends, and now I've started doing more survey work as well, trying to understand a little bit what's happening. So as an empirical starting point, what I realized to some extent to my relief being Romanian is that the Romanians were not alone in going crazy. It seemed that after a while, after a period of relative party system consolidation in the mid-1990s, suddenly the political party scene in Eastern Europe blew up again. And as I'll show you in a little bit, this happened along a wide variety of cases. And what's interesting is that it happened in very different directions. So you don't just have a return of the communists, or you don't just have fascists. It's a mix of people, actually. And so what I'm trying to explain in this project is, on one hand, what explains the appeal of these anti-establishment political parties, and on the other hand, what are the implications? I mean, how worried do we need to be in terms of what this means for electoral politics and for democracy in Eastern Europe? Side note on what I mean by anti-establishment parties. This was one of the frustrations of trying to start work on this subject, is realizing that there wasn't a very good typology of political parties, particularly for Eastern Europe. And so what I started to do is I created a typology, and I'm happy to talk more about it in the Q&A. For now, I'd rather sort of focus on the survey work. But I define anti-establishment parties as parties that deviate from what we think of the sort of classic Western model of a political party, i.e. a party that is primarily focused on, centered around a recognizable mainstream ideology. Right, so you have social democratic parties, you have liberal parties, you have conservative parties, and so on. And sort of by default, what that means is that anti-establishment parties are parties that deviate from this moderate ideological party type of model. And they can deviate in a number of different ways. They can either deviate by being based on the personality of its leaders. So, you know, if you're the party of person X, and the party of the Bulgarian king, former king, then prime minister, is one of the clear examples. That gives you a sense that this is probably not a party that's organized around ideological tenets, but rather based on the appeal of a personality. And obviously, parties are mixes of personality and ideological appeals, but we can definitely see variation. And the other question is the extent to which these parties adopt anti-establishment and extremist rhetoric. And in that sense, we can differentiate between a number of different deviations from what can be seen as the mainstream establishment political profile. One dimension is anti-capitalism, and by this I don't mean, you know, social democratic. You know, we need to balance the market with some state intervention, but people who basically say we need to go back to the communist system, right? So they're the hardcore communists. Then the second group, and this has been sort of very visible as well, is parties that appeal based on ethnic particularism. And here I differentiate between extreme nationalist parties and national populist parties. with the former being more extreme in their anti-minority rhetoric, and sometimes even inciting to violence and actually engaging in acts of violence. And finally, there's ethnic minority parties, and these I will not talk about much today. In a sense, obviously, they are non-ideological parties, and they do play on the ethnic-religious dimension, but I don't know that we should necessarily consider them as being anti-establishment, except insofar as they distrust the establishment and therefore think that there is a need for an ethnic party, right? If the needs of the minority would be taken care of within the regular party system, you wouldn't need to have a Hungarian party or a Bulgarian or a Slovak party and so on. And then finally, this is the issue that I first talked about. You can get these personalist parties that, you know, a lot of times actually reject ideology and who say, you know, this is the person who will save Bulgaria, or this is the person who will save Slovakia. And that doesn't mean that they are out to get the minorities, it doesn't mean that they're against capitalism, but they basically reject, it's a sort of centrist rejection of the mainstream. And this is one of the sort of interesting new developments in the last few years. So what about the timeline? We've looked at sort of a range of the parties. What about a sort of broad timeline of these elections? Well, broadly speaking, we can think of elections being of three kinds. They're the initial elections that everybody knows about, and those largely pitted the communist against fairly vague and fairly broad anti-communist coalitions. Right, all of these parties at the beginning were not even called parties. Most of them were called, you know, Civic Forum, National Salvation Front, and so on. And their main organizing principle was that they were against the communists. Right, so you have these two camps basically facing off in the first election, and relatively limited party differentiation as a consequence. What you get in the second generation elections is, for the most part, the incumbents get kicked out. Right, this is one of the big regularities in East European elections. It's very, very rare, particularly in the more democratic countries, that an incumbent government gets reelected. And usually, if they do get reelected, that's because they're not democratic enough, right? I mean, there are exceptions from this, and Romania is one of the exceptions where the ex-communists only lost power in 96. But for the most part, especially in the Central European countries, Hungary, Poland, and so on, we see this alternation in power. What we also see in the second generation elections is a lot more party differentiations. So the broad anti-communist fronts of the first elections basically break apart, and we get something that looks a lot more like a traditional Western sort of party systems. Whether these parties actually adhere to the tenets of liberalism, Christian democracy, social democracy in every respect, that's an open question, but still we start seeing a party system that looks a lot more stable and a lot more normal from the point of view of a Western observer. What we also see, though, and this is the downside of it, is we see the rise of nationalist parties during these elections. Right, and so you start seeing everywhere, from the Czech Republic to Hungary to Poland to Romania and so on, these ethno-nationalist parties. And of course, in a sense, that's part of becoming more like the West as well. If you look at Italy or Austria or France, they've got their fascists as well. So, you know, why shouldn't the East Europeans? Okay, so this is what, in a sense, happens at the level of the second generation elections. And at that point, a lot of people basically said, okay, fine, you know, there's been, in the sense of party systems, the transition is more or less over. We have party systems that look relatively similar to the West, and, you know, we're going to start seeing this alteration and so on. And then what happens in the third generation elections, and this is not, what I should point out, this is not the third election necessarily. What I mean by third generation elections is an election that takes place after both the main political camps have been in power. Right? So after, usually this means the ex-communists and the sort of center-right reformers. In some cases, as in Slovakia or in Croatia, it might mean the nationalists and the reformers. But what it means from the point of view of the voters is that they've basically seen the two mainstream alternatives in power, and for the most part, they haven't been very impressed. And as a consequence, what we see in these elections is we see a rise of anti-establishment parties. Very prominent here is the rise of these new centrist populist parties. I will talk more about the National Simeon II movement in Bulgaria, but in the Baltics, in a number of other countries, you start to see what I call centrist populist parties, one can call them a number of different things. And again, what these parties are about is that they reject the mainstream and the corruption and the incompetence that the public associates with it, and try to offer an alternative, either along ideological or personalistic lines. The other thing that we see, and that will not be as much a focus of this talk today, is a growing support for the left. Has happened less in Bulgaria and Romania, the two countries that I'm going to look at more closely, but has happened a lot. I mean, in Moldova in 2001, the unreformed communists come back to power with 50% of the vote. So, you know, it's a little bit of a Weimar scenario, but in the sort of on the left side, with unreformed communists winning democratic elections and fairly clean elections. Czech Republic, you also see, I mean, it doesn't just happen in the poor countries. Czech Republic, the communists get almost 20% of the vote in the 2002 election and so on. So there is a return of the radical left as well. And as we'll see, at least in some of the countries, a continuation or even rise of the vote for the radical right. Just very quickly, I guess I should have put this up earlier. Here are the vote shares in a number of selected third generation elections. And I've basically split them into radical left, centrist populist, and extreme nationalist parties. And what you see is that there's different patterns across countries, right? So in Bulgaria, the main winners were centrist populist parties, in particular the party of the former king. In the Czech Republic, it's the communists who strike it big. In Hungary, it's more the nationalists and the extreme nationalists in 98. Moldova, like I mentioned, the communists get most of this protest vote. And then there are a couple of countries, especially Poland and Latvia, that have the sort of tricolor. They managed to get, and actually to some extent Slovakia as well, they managed to get anti-establishment of all sorts, right? So in Poland, you get 10% for the left-wing Samobrona, you get 9% and then 27% in the recent elections for a sort of centrist populist party of the Kaczyński brothers. And then you get the extreme nationalist, the League of Polish Families, with about 8%. Right? So you have a pretty significant presence of various stripes of anti-establishment parties. But the patterns vary, obviously, both over time and across countries. So how can we explain these variations? And I have, in another paper, done some cross-national regressions of what seems to drive these facts. And one of the things that comes out very clearly is that third-generation elections do see an overall rise in anti-establishment parties, right? So what we talked about. But I'm not going to get into that here. Today I'd like to talk more about survey evidence that tries to explain why we get these kinds of votes and how worried we should be about this. Okay? And in terms of a theoretical framework for thinking about this, I'm going to look at it. Much of these explanations have been basically of two varieties. Either by saying, well, it must mean that these guys are ideological extremists and so on, or it must mean that it's a protest vote. And people have talked a lot about it. I don't think that there has been a lot of systematic effort to try to disentangle how one would look at what these two different predictions mean. And because of that, I'm going to try to talk briefly about prospective versus retrospective voting, obviously borrowing from the voting literature in Western democracies. And in order to have prospective voting, obviously what you need is you need an identifiable platform difference between parties. Right, so you need to have several different dimensions across which parties differ. And this can be economic policy, whether you're more for the state, more for the market, and that's been the sort of classic cleavage between the ex-communists and the reformers. It can be about nationalism, minority politics, it can be about Western integration, it can be about democracy. In reality, the problem in Eastern Europe is that this is undermined by a number of issues. First of all, there are a lot of changing party names, politicians, and so on. If you start following the names of these parties, it gets dizzying very, very quickly. Second, a lot of the people, even to the extent that the parties survive, they move from one party to another. And that's, again, very confusing for politicians. If suddenly somebody who was a Christian Democrat yesterday is a fascist today and might be a Social Democrat tomorrow, right? It creates a lot of confusion. The other aspect is the discrepancy between electoral platforms and policies. And this has been particularly the case for the ex-communist parties, which usually would campaign on this sort of, you know, capitalism is tough, these reforms have hurt a lot of people, and then they come into power and they do more or less what the reformers have done. Right? So that again creates a lot of dissonance if you want to know who you're going to vote for. Then there are mixed signals. Again, some of these parties would like to project one image towards the West and another image towards their voters, particularly when it comes to issues like minorities and so on. And then finally, and there's some stuff been written on this, the constraints on internationally acceptable platforms. Right? If you want to be invited as a prime minister to go to the various meetings and so on, you cannot say certain types of things. And that again, I mean, that feeds into the whole dual platform thing where people like Mečiar in Slovakia has tried to play this game of being a little bit more presentable towards the West and then on the other hand appealing to nationalists within Slovakia, and found relatively quickly that there wasn't a lot of leeway. Right, and as a consequence, basically the West puts a lot of pressure and tries to sideline people like Mečiar, people like Tučman in Croatia and so on. So all of these things basically make it much harder for parties to really present a coherent message to the voters. What about retrospective voting? Well, obviously this is much more widespread, right? Because it's very easy. It may be hard to tell whether these guys are really Christian Democrats. What's very easy to tell is whether they've done a good job or a bad job. And what this has meant for the most part is that it was a negative vote. And that's why you get these huge incumbency disadvantages in Eastern Europe, with the ruling parties almost always losing a lot of their votes in the following elections and sometimes getting entirely wiped out. Right? The problem with this retrospective voting is that it's not always clear who's going to get blamed. Right, you get a lot of governments that are coalition governments, and then who do you blame? You know, there are several parties, there might be several culprits, and we'll see that that's not always obvious and it's not always uniform. Not everybody who's in the government gets necessarily punished, nor is it clear necessarily who is going to gain from the opposition. Right, there are a number of different ways they can go. So what does this mean in terms of different generations of elections? Well, in the first election, obviously, there's no post-communist track record to speak of. So people basically base their retrospective voting on how they evaluate the communist system. In the second generation elections, obviously, they evaluate the first post-communist government. And what we get as a consequence is what initially was seen as this healthy power alternation. Right, people say that you get democratic consolidation when you have at least two peaceful changes of government and so on. So initially this is good news. But then what happens in the third generation elections? Well, at that point, people have run out of mainstream alternatives. Right, the ex-communists didn't do so great, the reformers didn't do so great, who do you vote for next? And that's essentially the big dilemma of the third generation elections. And then if we put these things together, we get essentially four profiles of voting, right? If both retrospective and prospective voting are relatively unimportant, then that's fairly random voting, right? That means I don't care about what this party says it's gonna do. I don't care about what the parties have done. It's not exactly clear what else there is left. I mean, this could also be sort of the person, just purely person-based voting. If, on the other hand, you have a lot of retrospective considerations, but not a lot of prospective voting, then you get protest voting, right? So this would be the sort of voting that says, I don't care who I vote for as long as these damn communists are not going to get voted in again. Right? And at that point, I might vote for reformers, I might vote for fascists, I might vote for an ethnic minority party, I might vote for, you know, the beer drinkers party in Poland, you know, which got about 3% of the votes at some point in 91, I think. Right? So this doesn't tell us who we're going to vote for, but it tells us who we're not going to vote for to a large extent. On the bottom part, if I'm very interested by prospective conditions, but not very much by retrospective, there will be the ideological voting box. Right? So the idea here is, yeah, the communists were in power, they didn't do a great job, but I believe in what they stand for, and I really hate the other guys, so I'm going to vote for them anyway. And then finally, the balance voting, and this is, you know, presumably what we would want, is a combination of the two, taking into account the performance, but also seeing the extent to which these parties' promises line up with one's own preferences. Okay, and basically for the rest of the talk, I don't know if I can go any faster than I already am. I'm going to try to look at empirical evidence from these two recent surveys that I've done. And one of them was done in Romania in November, December 2004, and the other one in the recent elections in Bulgaria at the end of June of 2005. And just a quick justification of why I'm looking at these countries. I mean, obviously, I'm from Romania, so that's where the initial interest came from, but I do think that these are two interesting cases to compare for a number of different reasons. For one thing, it's almost impossible to find countries that are more neatly paired in terms of initial conditions, right? They have comparative development levels, relatively medium-low levels of development, pretty similar urbanization, historical legacies, and so on. And actually a remarkably similar minority situation. Both of them have about 8-9% ethnic minority, Turkish in the case of Bulgaria, Hungarian in the case of Romania. Both of them have about 10% Roma. And both of them actually have a history of the communists exploiting nationalist sentiments during the 1980s. So it's very nicely paired, certainly in terms of ethnic politics. In both cases, you get ex-communist dominance until 97. In Bulgaria, there was a short interval of rule by the reformers in 91-92, but for the most part, the communists dominate the early part of the decade. In both cases, you also get these very optimistic reformist victories in 96-97. And at that point, there was an article in the Journal of Democracy entitled "Bulgaria's Symphony of Hope." Well, that was pretty much the dominant sentiment there. It's like, we got rid of this nasty communist, now's the time we're going to do all of this great stuff. Right? And what happens is that after 4 years, and the Bulgarians actually had a little bit more reason to be hopeful, they had a much better economic performance and political performance from 97 to 2001. But what you get in both cases is that the reformers basically get punished in the following election. And what's remarkable, even though the Bulgarian reformers did a lot better than the Romanian ones did, both of them got about 20% of the vote in the 2001 elections, namely losing almost half of their votes from the previous election. Right? So it seems almost that people were not particularly sensitive as to how well the country was doing. They still punished the incumbents. But where the differences come in, other than the fact that the reformers got punished, is in terms of what happens with the other parties. And what you get in Romania, and we're going to look at the electoral results very shortly, is that the ex-communists win the elections again, and very clearly this time. And about 20% of the vote go to this Greater Romania party, which is about as nasty as an extremist party in Eastern Europe or anywhere can get. I mean, this is it's led by this guy, Corneliu Vadim Tudor, who was a former court poet to Nicolae Ceaușescu. You know, the sort of guy who would write poems about the genius of the Carpathians and so on. And then he's been running this extreme right newspaper in Romania, which articles written under pseudonym, but clearly written by him, in which he says that, you know, gypsies should be put in concentration camps, that Jews are running the country and should be kicked out. I mean, you know, about as lowbrow as you can get, right? As well as, you know, being against gays, being against Hungarians, being against anyone you can possibly imagine who's not a, you know, good Christian, straight, whatever, Romanian, right? And this guy gets 30% in the presidential elections, and this party with basically no political experience gets 20% in the parliamentary elections. So pretty serious shakeup. In Bulgaria, you get a very different shakeup. And what happens there is that the former king, who was 6 years when he was kicked out by the communists, but had been ruling through regents, I don't know exactly what a six-year-old can rule in 1946, but he comes back and within 2 months puts together a party that wins 43% of the vote. And he would have won 48% of the vote if two other parties that were called almost the same thing hadn't siphoned off another 5% of the vote. Right? There was a national coalition of Simeon II, and then there was a coalition for Tsar Simeon. I don't even know who set those guys up, but those guys got 5% without even doing anything. Right? So comes and takes basically half the vote. And in the process, basically, destroys not just the center-right, the reformers who have been in power, but also the ex-communists. And there's basically no space left for anyone else. What you see in 2004-2005 is, to some extent, a little bit of convergence again, in the sense that the extreme nationalists get weaker in Romania and get stronger in Bulgaria. Right, so it's whereas there had been no extreme nationalists in any of the previous Bulgarian elections, and then in the ex-King's party declines from 43% to about 20%, and the ex-communists recover again. So you start, and I'm not going to get too much into this, but at this point the party systems don't look that different anymore again in terms of the vote shares. So very quickly, and now I'm basically going to talk about two elections in Romania, the 2000 elections and the 2004 elections, and trying to see who supported this, particularly the extremist party, and what does that mean, you know, what does that mean for protest voting versus ideological voting versus random voting or anything else. Just very briefly, the election results, I had already talked about this before. So in 96, you get a victory of the center-right reformist opposition. They basically get destroyed in 2000, and you get the large vote share for the PRN, the Extreme Nationalist Party. And the Greens, green means that these are the parties that ended up forming the government. And one interesting thing to see is that the Hungarian minority has managed to be in every government since 1996. Which is interesting, and it's actually not that different from Bulgaria, as we'll see, and may account for the relative peace, ethnic peace in these countries compared to Yugoslavia. Because basically their PR system makes it such that the ethnic minority parties are kingmakers. That's not part of this, but I think it's a sort of interesting sideline. And then you get the 2004 elections, in which, as you see, the extreme nationalists go from 20% to about 13%, so a pretty significant drop. You see a recovery of the center-right again, and the ex-communists basically stay at the same level. Right? So what happens in 2000? So remember, 2000 was the year of the great gain for the PRM, for the extreme right. Who did they get their votes from? And here, a short caveat. I mean, basically, the problem with looking at this kind of data is that that people don't remember very well who they voted for before. So this we have to take with a little grain of salt, but it's still interesting to look at it. So they basically get almost a third of their votes from the former governing reformers. Right? So this is strange, right? A third of these people had voted for the good pro-Western, pro-democracy, pro-minority governing parties in 96, and suddenly they vote fascist. Only a third of them had actually voted for these guys before. 17% had voted for the ex-communists and so on. So pretty motley crew of people. In terms of the actually that's not worth talking about. So what happens to the incumbents? As you can see, they get punished. So only 16% of the people who voted for the Democratic Convention in 96 voted for them again in 2000. Right. So this is a dramatic loss. They get one in six of the votes of the people who voted for them before. And what we see is that some of them go to the PRM, a lot of them actually go to the ex-communists, which is the sort of standard expectation that we would have. So what about the theoretical predictions? And here I'll walk you through the first. So this is basically, rather than showing you statistical sort of regression results, I'm just going to show you tables with the direction of it. I think it's a little bit easier to, rather than trying to look at coefficients. So I ran logistical regression models based on the vote choice of these of people. And so here, what I've done is I've split it into retrospective voting predictions and prospective voting predictions. Right? So what we would expect is that people who are happy with the government's performance should be more likely to vote for the parties that have been in the government, right? These parties here. And the ones who are unhappy or who think that there's a lot of corruption should vote for the opposition parties. That's the sort of standard retrospective voting prediction. In terms of the prospective voting, I've looked at a number of indicators, particularly important Western integration, whether they're for or against it, economic liberalism, ethnic tolerance and democratic support, right? So the parties of the former government, which had been a sort of classic center-right pro-West pro-democratic parties, would expect to be positive on all of these dimensions. So the people who support them should basically share their values of, you know, tolerance and democracy and so on. The PRM, which are the extreme right, should basically be opposed to all of these things, because that was their platform pretty much across the board. Where it becomes a little bit trickier is for the ex-communists, who on one hand by 2000 had declared that they're in favor of Western integration, that they're going to respect democracy and minority rights and so on. They're a little bit more mixed about economic liberalism. Right? So they would basically say, look, we're fine with capitalism, but you know, we should maybe take it a little bit more easy and so on. So what are the results? So what I've done here is in the left column for each party, and I apologize if this is really confusing, but I couldn't figure out an easier way to do it. So the left column is always the predicted effect, and in the right column are the actual effects based on the regressions. Right? And what we see is, looking at the retrospective voting part, is that the only ones who actually got punished were the CDR. Right? For these guys, whoever thought that the government performance was good was more likely to vote for them. But considering that the government performance was very poor, they were the ones who bore the brunt of the protest vote. And that's why, if we would go back to the election results, they didn't even make it into parliament. Their coalition partners, on the other hand, who had been in government with them for 4 years, were not affected by this, or much less affected. And you can actually see that there is no statistically significant result on vote choice for them, depending on how the government was made. So this is, yeah. So
the Prime Minister was a Christian Democrat. The most visible person in the government was a Christian Democrat.
Yes, he was, and in a sense, that's, I mean, the CDR was seen as the major party in this, and that's partly probably why. Though it's actually, if you look at the Hungarian elections of 98, there the minor coalition party gets punished. So it's not always, but in this case, yes, it's probably that the CDR was the party that was most clearly associated with the failures of the 96 to 2000 government, right? And then if we look at the opposition parties, it seems that the party that benefited the most was the PRM, the extreme right. So the people who were really unhappy with the government tended to vote for the extreme right. And that makes sense to some extent, because a lot of people still remember the not so great governing performance of the ex-communists 4 years earlier. Right? So if you're really unhappy with how the government is run, you vote for the guys who've never been in power. Now what about the ideological voting? Here what you find, again, the most consistent support is for the CDR. So their supporters really were a lot more pro-Western, pro-economic reforms, pro-Western integration, and so on. Fairly consistent also for their coalition partners. What's interesting in the case of the PRM is that they tend to be less tolerant of minorities and less supportive of democracy, but they don't seem to really be more against against Western integration or economic liberalism. Right, so these guys, it seems that there's a certain part of the PRM propaganda that worked a lot better than the rest. What is more surprising, however, is the fact that the ex-communist voters, despite the fact that at this point the ex-communists were very much a social democratic mainstream parties in terms of their electoral campaign, actually attracted voters who were opposed to Western integration and who were anti-democratic in their attitudes. Right? So this is arguably a very successful case of doing a dual message, of playing the civilized message towards the West and then sort of going to the campaign rallies and saying, hey, you know what, we're still kind of the same guys. Okay, so what about theoretical predictions for 2004? I promise it's gonna get a little faster because it's the same parties, right? So we more or less expect the same sort of thing, where the center-right should be in favor of all of these, you know, democracy, minority rights, and so on. The PRM should be against. The only difference is slightly with respect to democracy, and that is because the ex-communists had actually been fairly authoritarian in their governing style in the last year or so. I mean, we're talking about a Freedom House score going, you know, from a 5 to 4 or whatever. Not a huge thing, but they were trying to clamp down on the media. There was definitely evidence that they were that they were trying to sort of tighten the grip on the state. What happens in reality? Well, retrospective voting works beautifully. So, by the way, I should have mentioned that before. Everything that's marked in blue means that it supports the prediction, and everything that's marked in red goes against the prediction. Right? So, again, the center-right is very well predicted by the by ideological expectations, except for minority rights, where they're actually not anymore tolerant than the rest. And that's something we're going to see in the Bulgarian case as well, and it's a little bit disturbing. With the PRM, what you see is that now they're actually more consistent. Their voters are more consistent with them. They still don't seem to care too much about economic liberalism, but they do care about Western integration. They're also more negative on Western integration and so on. So in a sense, the voters have aligned with the anti-Western and anti-democratic party platform. And what we see in the case of the ex-communist is that they're still opposed to economic liberalism, but by now they're also in favor of Western integration. So this is 4 years later. Romania is on the way to getting into the EU and so on, and it seems that these voters have sort of jumped ship. So what does this mean? How can we explain this support for the PRM? We've seen that they're increasingly congruent. They seem to be increasingly congruent with the preferences of their voters. But of course, not everybody votes for the same reasons. So what I've done is I've created basically a matrix in which I've divided people into pro-West versus anti-West, and this is depending on their attitudes towards European integration. And then I created an index of tolerance, which is based on these very standard questions of which of the following minorities would you or would you not like to have as neighbors? And the minorities I'm looking at for the sake of comparability are Jews, Hungarians, and Roma in the case of Romania. And then in the case of Bulgaria, I'm looking at Jews, Turks, and Roma. So just switching the Turks for the Hungarians, but otherwise keeping the scale and everything else the same. And what we find here is that the core voters, who are both anti-Western and intolerant, are only 11% of the actual vote for the PRM. Right, so not that many of these people are really hardcore sort of anti-Western fascists. That's the good news. About another 45% are either intolerant and pro-West or sort of mixed and anti-West. So these are people who I would hear core leaning. Right, they're pretty close to the platform, but they don't completely coincide. And then all the people who are either yellow or orange are actually shouldn't really be voting for the PRM, at least as far as we can tell based on their attitudes, right? The confused ones are really mysterious because they're both tolerant and pro-West, yet they vote for a party that is fascist and anti-West. Kind of interesting, right? So that's sort of the good news. That means that theoretically, at least half of the votes, about half of the votes of the PRM could easily be dislocated if the mainstream is a little bit more attractive. Now, what's the bad news? These are the non-PRM voters. And 3% of them are really fascists. They just don't know it, or they're not voting accordingly. So these are people that should have really voted platform-wise for the PRM and didn't. What's even more disturbing is that about another third of the overall population is actually sort of leaning towards the position. So either they're anti-West, but more importantly, they're intolerant. And this is something, this is what we'll see in the Bulgarian case as well, is that the big problem is not on pro-West, anti-West. We see that, 93% of these voters are pro-West. The problem is that about a third of people are quite intolerant. And this means, I don't want to live next to Roma, I don't want to live next to Hungarians, I don't want to live next to Jews. Or at least, I'd rather not. Right? So this is theoretically a potential that the PRM could tap into. And it's something that in a sense sort of can create these kinds of constituencies for future votes. Very quickly about the Bulgarian elections. I'm not going to talk too much about the results. I've already talked about them before. Basically, you get center-right victory in 97, followed by the victory for the King's Party in 2001, and then 2005, the victory of the ex-communists and the rise of the Ataka, the extreme nationalist party. Right, and the Bulgarians are very upset because they were used to they were used to being basically, you know, the one party in Eastern Europe that didn't have a fascist party, and now they do. As you'll see later on, if you look at the preferences, it's not all that surprising. So, just very briefly, where did the votes for the king come from in 2001? Remember, king comes in, 2 months later wins 43% of the vote. And what you see is that over 54% of the people who had voted for the center-right in 97 voted for the king in 2004. So that is really the a good chunk of where the vote came from. But at the same time, even the socialists lost almost a third of their voters to the king's party. Of people who voted for other parties, more than two-thirds voted for the king. And even the MRF, which is the Turkish minority party, 20% of their people voted for the king. Right, so these guys came and basically cleaned up the political spectrum, managed to get votes from everybody. In terms of the actual sources of NSM support, so for the King's Party, you see that half of them came from the UDF with a few from the socialists, et cetera. Right, so essentially what happens, and this is why the center-right is very upset at the king comes in and basically steals their votes. They would have won the election of 97 if it hadn't been for the king coming in. What are the theoretical predictions? Well, so here, and this is unfortunately, this is a survey where they didn't ask a lot of political attitude questions, and in the process of getting some better data. So what I've looked at in addition to government performance for retrospective voting, I've looked at religiosity, which should benefit the Christian Democrats, and I've looked at democratic support, which should theoretically benefit all three of these parties because they are all at that point in the process of you know playing within the democratic system. So we'd expect the people who are non-democratic to either vote for smaller extremist parties or not to vote at all, right? So what do we find? For one thing, we do find that retrospective voting seems to predict it quite well, and in particular, it explains the sort of punishment of the governing party, as well as the success of the king's party, right? So that works out well. What works out less well is the prospective voting here, right? The ex-communists are actually a lot less supportive of democracy. This is very similar to what we found in Romania, and in the case of the king's party, they actually tend to be more religious than the Christian Democrats, even though they call themselves a liberal party. So you can see that prospective voting is pretty jumbled up in the 97 elections.
Okay, well, this is strange. Oh, I'm sorry, this is completely out of order.
So, okay, so where did the, now moving on to 2005. Where did the voters for Ataka come from? And I'm just going to focus on Ataka. So Ataka is the extreme nationalist party at this point. And what we see is that about a third of them come from the King's Party. And to some extent that makes sense, right? These are voters that were dislocated before from the mainstream parties and are now sort of free to go somewhere else because they might not be happy with the king. Also, though, and this is somewhat surprising, 20% of them come from the UDF, which is the center-right, the reformers. So again, we see a fairly big crossover between people who would have been considered as pro-democracy voters 4 years ago and who now vote fascist. So what explains the actual vote choice? And here again, what we find is that they are actually quite well predicted by extremist voting, right? So the people who voted for Ataka were less likely to believe in Western integration, didn't want closer Western ties, were less ethnically tolerant, and were less supportive of democracy. So there is a fair amount of support for the just pure extremism vote. On the other hand, and this is I think very indicative, none of the ideological predictions predict a vote for the former King's Party, right? So this is purely a vote. This is not about what this party stands for. This is a vote for a person, or at least for something other than ideology, because none of these things seem to predict the vote for the king. The center-right opposition, as we might expect, is favored by people who want closer ties to the West, but somewhat surprisingly, they're actually less ethnically tolerant than the average voter. And this is a very strange and worrisome, I think, phenomenon, is to have a party that is very widely seen as the good guys being actually supported by a lot of people who don't really like minorities. Right? So they're pro-West, but they seem to be anti-minority. And here's the same story. What about Ataka voters? How fascist or how extremist are they? And here what we find is that about 27% of them really do fit the description of being both intolerant and anti-Western. But again, almost half of them should not really, well, about 40% of them don't really belong there and could probably be picked up by someone else. The flip side of the story is, again, a lot of 39% of Bulgarians are completely intolerant towards minorities. And that's a pretty good reservoir for Ataka in the future should the need arise. Right? So these are people, it seems that if Ataka would only get rid of its anti-Western appeals, it might be able to get a lot more votes because there's certainly enough voters out there who don't like minorities. Right? So that's a fairly popular message to send out. And it's an interesting trade-off. So what are the theoretical conclusions? I'm sorry for running late. Well, first of all, there is evidence in favor of both retrospective and prospective voting. But the strengths are actually depend on which parties and which elections you look at. So prospective voting works well in explaining the center-right. For the most part, these people really are more supportive of democracy and so on. And it works fairly well for expanding opposition parties because there you don't know why you would vote for one versus the other. It doesn't work so well for ex-communist parties, and that's because of the tensions that I've talked about between their domestic message and their international message. And it also is undermined by the platform changes and ambiguous appeals, right? With these parties that try to have it both ways and sort of change from one time to another. Retrospective voting works quite well for single-party incumbents. Where it doesn't work so well is for multiple incumbents, as we've seen in Romania in 2000. One party gets punished, the other one doesn't. And then finally, and this is really, and unfortunately, this is something that I always manage to do, is I talk too much in the main part of the talk, and then I don't get to talk enough about the conclusions. But it seems that it's not just a question of, yeah, both theories are kind of right and kind of wrong. It's about the fact that, in a sense, we need to combine these two theories to explain the sort of vote choice for these anti-establishment parties. And I think that the way to go about it, and the way I'd like to hear your opinion on this, is that, in a sense, the magnitude of the anti-establishment vote is driven by the dissatisfaction with the mainstream elite. Right? So if people are really unhappy with the current government and maybe with the previous government and so on, they're more likely to be looking somewhere else. But what retrospective voting cannot tell us is where these people are going to go. And this is, as we've seen if we look at the cross-national evidence, these people go in a variety of different places. So the question is, why do they vote for a communist in one case, for fascist in another, for monarchists, well, not even monarchists, for the king in another, and then for parties that call themselves, the new party or the new era party or the, very sort of generic names elsewhere. And what I argue here is that they're basically, the protest vote tends to go where there's already some existing nucleus, right? So the reason why the Romanians, I think, in 2000 voted for the extreme right is because there had been an extreme right presence before. And Vadim Tudor, who was their leader, is a very charismatic person. He did very well on TV debates and so on. And he was the one who screamed the loudest on those debates. And I think it really matters that you can scream the loudest. Because at that point, the people who are unhappy with the mainstream elite say, well, that's the obvious choice, right? So there is somebody there, because, many are called, few are chosen in terms of these kinds of extremist politics. In the Romanian case, I guess it's both a pre-existing nationalist party and a political personality. Arguably, what happened in Bulgaria in 2001 is Bulgarians were not monarchists. I don't have the data here, but I think less than 15% of them would have favored a return to the monarchy. But you basically have the king who comes in and he's seen as somebody who's respected in the West and so on, and he's an obvious choice and a fairly innocuous choice to a way to punish the elite. Right? I may not vote for a fascist just to punish the mainstream elite, but if I vote for the king, you know, the king is a pretty nice guy, you know, he's still going to take us to Europe, it's not such a big deal. So I think that's and obviously that's very contingent, unfortunately, and it's hard to do, you know, who predicts the next person coming about. So what are the implications for democracy for this? For one thing, and this is something that we see in every survey, is that there's a lot of dissatisfaction with how democracy works. There's a lot of dissatisfaction and low trust in the political elites, and that creates openings for extremist parties. Moreover, and this is the other problem, is that there's a high degree of latent intolerance. Right? Even to the extent that people don't go bashing each other's heads in, they would rather not deal with the minorities. And you know, you talk to perfectly reasonable people, and they'll tell you things about the Roma minority that you really don't want to hear. So it's a very tricky situation. And the problem with this is that these extremist parties, which at this point are a very visible presence on the Romanian party system and Bulgarian party system, can become the nucleus for the future protest vote. Right? They're already there. If the next government does really badly, they know where to go, and they could go there. The other problem with this and with the anti-incumbency bias is that this gives very short-term incentives to politicians. If you know you're going to get kicked out in the next elections, what are you going to do? Well, you're going to try to steal as much as possible, because chances are you're not going to get reelected. And this is something that you see a lot in these countries, and obviously becomes self-reinforcing, because if you steal a lot, then people don't want to re-vote you in. What about some reasons for cautious optimism, just so we don't end on this note? Well, for one thing, extremists don't really get higher vote shares in Eastern Europe for the most part than they get in much of Western Europe, right? If you look at France, if you look at Austria, if you look at Italy, it doesn't look that much worse than Romania or Bulgaria. So in that sense, maybe we're just becoming European. The trust in political parties and in the parliament, which is very low, worrisome in a lot of ways, is actually, again, very similar to Western Europe. So maybe this is just sort of, you know, the usual malaise of parliamentary democracies. I think the key question here is the return to Europe and the support for Western integration. Right? The vast majority of people and the vast majority of the elites want to get into the EU, want to be part of this whole sort of Western liberal project. And I think that in the process, they're willing to maybe give minorities more rights and maybe sort of, you know, go along with these norms. And I think that that's where the hope is, because if we get a generation of this kind of politics, we will eventually hopefully outgrow the intolerance. The other aspect that I, you know, may or may not work is that as the economy is improving and corruption is brought under control, again through EU conditionality and so on, hopefully the reason for the voters to be upset at the governing elite might diminish over time, and as a consequence might give sort of less fodder for these extremists. Thanks.
Yeah. Just a small question, clarification. In the election where you said there were two parties with the king's name in Bulgaria,
yeah,
was the smaller one in support of him, or was it created to siphon off votes? Because I've heard of cases in Russia where you'll have candidates with very similar sounding names placed on the ballot to confuse the voter and siphon votes away.
I'm almost positive that it was to siphon off votes. It was actually remarkable, because I kept asking people there, and they didn't really know about it. I mean, this is something that's done very, very frequently in Romania as well. You know, putting a party with a very similar name, a very similar electoral sign, you know, just to siphon off. I mean, I don't see why, in what way it could have helped. And the funny thing is that one of them almost made it into parliament. Right, but yeah, I think it was largely. I mean, it might have been just the confusion of the electoral campaign, but I'm almost positive that it was to siphon off.
To what extent do the communist parties or ex-communist parties conceal their backgrounds or play them down? Especially, I'm thinking of Romania, where you had such a bizarre communist regime for so long. Was it possible for these parties to drop the previous affiliation, or how did they convey a difference, if they did?
Yeah. Well, actually, since you bring up the Romanian case is very strange, because unlike elsewhere, where the ex-communist parties basically changed name to socialist or social democratic, in Romania they outlawed the Communist Party and created this National Salvation Front, which very vehemently denied that they were communist. Of course, it so happened that they had a lot of former high-ranking communists in their ranks, but they didn't actually, they were very, partly because the regime was so unpopular. And the people who were in charge of the National Salvation Front were not people who were high in the Ceausescu regime in the last few years. They had been sort of the sort of Gorbachev reformers, basically, who had been sidelined. So in Romania, it's a very strange story. What you get for the most part is this sort of grudging acceptance of saying, oh, well, you know, communism wasn't that great. Yeah, we made some mistakes. We're going to become social democratic now. They all basically try to get into the Socialist International and Social Democratic International. And in the process, basically try to moderate their platforms. So they obviously take out anything about, you know, the Communist Party being the ruling party and so on. And also basically pandering more or less to the West. Because domestically, there are enough of the voters who are just happy to keep a lot of the state-owned enterprises and the welfare state and so on. So that's why I think we sort of see this funny two-level game almost, where they have to pretend that they're good Democrats and capitalists when they go to the West. And then when they go to the little towns in the back country, they'll play to a very different tune. So I don't know if that gets to that. Yes, Scott.
So I'm wondering about sort of, you know, and this is just the basic assumption in the literature, but treating these retrospective evaluations and ideological beliefs or preferences as basically orthogonal. So to what extent are people updating their beliefs about what the appropriate policy is based upon the retrospective evaluation? So you've got panel data in Romania, is that right? So yeah. Is it possible, for example, that voters who feel like the situation is worse today than they thought in 4 years before are more likely to be intolerant today, more likely to be anti-West today, and so on?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question, and I mean it can go in either direction. That you can sort of say, well, you know, I'm more likely to be a social democrat today because these reforms didn't work out so great, or is it the other way around? Unfortunately, I mean, the extent to which we have panel data is panel data between now and the month from there's no panel data from 4 years ago, and it's tricky. There's some data in Russia where they've been doing that. But even there, and you know, that's something that's interesting to look at. The problem there is that you get panel attrition that's very, very high, and at that point, it's not clear. I mean, even to the extent that, you know, if over a period of 4 or 5 years, you lose almost half of your people, you don't know whether the people you are left with are really representative anymore. I mean, you could still try to look at these kinds of, but that's one of the big limitations.
Do you see changes in the frequency distributions, at least, and like the proportion of people who say they don't want to live next to Hungarians, or the proportion of people who are anti-West? Does that change over time?
You know, the minority stuff and the anti-West, and that's something that unfortunately I'm trying to get some of this data. A lot of the times the questions are not asked in a completely consistent format, so it's a little bit hard. I mean, this was nice because I got to put the questions on the surveys, so I had the same scales for both countries. But, you know, for the longest time, they would ask these questions about the neighbors as, do you want, for the following groups, tell us if they're wanted or unwanted. Right? And it's very hard to say. I mean, do I want alcoholics to live next to me? Right? If you give me a scale from 1 to 4, I might say, well, you know, I may be indifferent. You know, same thing with minorities. A lot of people might say, I'm indifferent. But the wanted versus unwanted is a little bit of a tricky thing. So it's, at that point, it's a little bit hard to sort of compare these things across time. My sense from what I've seen, at least on the Romanian data, where this has been asked a little bit more consistently, is that the EU and the minority stuff has been fairly constant. People don't like minorities, and they like the West. I think that where you might start seeing differences is once these countries get into the EU, they will not be as excited about the EU anymore.
They realize the EU is full of minorities.
that's for one thing. Just wait until these Europeans start getting some some foreigners, actually. I mean, they already are to some extent, but it's only going to get worse. I mean, and this is actually one of the interesting phenomena in, if you look at this Eurobarometer data for Eastern Europe, the Bulgarians and the Romanians are always the most excited about the EU because they're the least likely to get in, right? The Czechs and the Slovenians are like, oh, yeah, we're going to get in, but there are all these problems, and, you know, we may have to pay some more money than what we're going to get, and so on. The Bulgarians love it. You know? So it's and strange enough, it's not just that they love it, but they actually know a lot about it. We asked some political knowledge questions about, you know, what the capital of the EU is. And something like 85% of Bulgarians knew that it was Brussels. I mean, that's pretty remarkable for people who, you know, a lot of them don't know what the name of the prime minister was, right? So it's something that they really know a lot about. And it's very sort of exciting. And then the closer they get, suddenly the carrot is not quite as exciting anymore. But it's that's something that's, I think, a longer term question. No, so that's exactly the problem. I mean, it happens a lot more in places like, places like Hungary and the Czech Republic and so on. These are places that had at least some context during the communist period. Russia actually as well, even though it didn't work out so great there. But they had people who had, you know, spent some time at the World Bank, been in the West and so on. You get a lot less of that kind of stuff out of the Soviet Union and out of the Balkans. So the Romanians just didn't have, you know, in the early period, there were just not a lot of people from inside who had not spent 40 years abroad. So, you know, what you get is, again, these sort of people who had been living in Britain for the last 40 years, coming back and sort of restarting these parties. And at some level, it was nice because they brought in a different perspective, but there are also people who, you know, if they had spent 40 years abroad, they were usually 75, 80 years old. So that sort of created some problems with the voters, just in terms of being able to communicate and so on. And plus, you know, they had not lived there for 40 years, and it makes the relating much harder. So, but I think you're right, and that I think touches on an important question: is how you, like, where do you draw the line of saying, okay, these guys are communists or not? And the Bulgarian socialists at some point had this funny, I mean, it was sort of a soul-searching thing where they said, you know, we need to decide whether we're the party of red cell phones or the party of red grannies. And there's a little bit of that, you know, like they still do a lot of things very similar to what they did under the communists, but it is this question of, do we get a new generation of people who, you know, are really fairly non-ideological, and might have still been brought up within the sort of party cadre and so on, but are ultimately, you know, slightly younger dogs who you can teach more tricks, right, than the old ones. And the problem is that there is much, much less in these in a lot of these sort of the farther east you were, the less of a sort of more westernized domestic elite that you have. So Hungary, for example, the people who came in and worked in the central bank and the finance ministry under the socialists in 1994, these are people who are actually very well trained economists who had sort of, you know, knew something at the start of the transition, and elsewhere the sort of trade-offs were much bigger.
Could you
yeah.
say something about what you said was not really part of your study, the minority parties in these kinds of countries?
Yeah.
Romania,
yeah. Yeah.
Do they get anybody into parliament? Are they ever sufficiently significant that the coalition government might want them as to put them over the top and make a coalition? And finally, does there tend to be rather coherent minority parties, even if they're small, or they tend to be like they were in Slovakia in the late 90s, 98, when there were sort of three of them which did come together in a coalition just for the election. But did get into the government, as I recall.
No, that's interesting, because I think the Slovakian case is that actually Macedonia is also a case where they have several Albanian minority parties. So here's the sort of question, the answer on the Bulgarian front. So the DPS is the minority party, and they're actually interesting because according to the Bulgarian constitution, there are not supposed to be any minority ethnic minority parties. So what they call themselves the Movement for Rights and Freedoms, and what they've done, and this is kind of remarkable, you see they've got 7.6, 7.7, and they got 12.7% of the vote in 2005. Which is a whole lot more than there are Turks in Bulgaria, right? So there's a little bit of a question, and part of it is that they managed to actually, this year when I was there, they managed to buy a lot of the vote of the Roma minority. And this is one of the sort of sad aspects of politics there, and it's something that I knew very little about until recently, is the extent to which if you go to these poor neighborhoods, the votes are basically bought. I mean, you know, this is something that happens in Argentina, happens in a lot of places, but it's fairly standard. And it seems that this time around, the Turkish minority party decided that it was worthwhile investing in the Roma votes. And they also bussed people around and did a bunch of other funny stuff. But what you see here is that they were actually in the coalition from 2001 to 2005, and they're in the current coalition. And they actually were in the coalition also until 94. So they've actually been in power more than almost anyone else on the scene. And that again is because of this polarized party system in which they can basically be the kingmakers. In some cases, literally the kingmakers, considering the party, right? The sort of, I mean, and that's good at some level because it does guarantee that the sort of state's policies are going to be fairly responsive to minorities. The problem also, though, and this is something that Ataka has played up a lot in these last elections, is that these guys actually become, because they are the kingmakers, end up being quite corrupt, selling basically their parliamentary support to whoever's going to take it. I mean, you know, they went with the king, they went with, now they're going with the socialists. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of differentiation there. Similar story in Romania. Let me just show you briefly. This is the Hungarian Minority Party. And you see, they get a very consistent part of the vote because they don't try to appeal to the Roma minority or anyone else. Their problem is that increasingly the Hungarian minority is actually shrinking because people are leaving to Hungary and they have low birth rates. And they might slip below the 5% threshold. The other problem is that also a lot of their voters, I think, are starting to get a little bit annoyed by the fact that, again, you know, they're in power with the anti-communists and they're in power with the communists, now they're in power with the anti-communists again. It's a little bit hard to sort of say that you have a consistent policy if you're doing that. Right? And it's also, it so happens that several of the Hungarian minority leaders are in the top 100 in the richest people in Romania. Probably not entirely unrelated to their participation in So that's, I mean, I don't know, was that, that's, okay, that's. What is, I think, sort of interesting is to see what, one of the things that I found in the cross-national work is that parties that actually, that countries with higher minority shares, as you would expect, they had higher votes for minority parties, but they didn't actually have higher votes for extremist parties. Right, so because you could sort of say, well, this is this sort of mutually reinforcing thing, where, you know, the minority feels threatened, so therefore they organize. But then if there's a minority party, then the majority sort of feels that, well, we should have our sort of nationalist guys as well, and you get this escalating forces. And what you actually see, you know, the Poles have a lot of nationalist votes, and they have no minorities whatsoever. I mean, apparently all it takes is 3,000 Jews to be able to be anti-Semitic as a country, right? Whereas on the other hand, countries like the Baltics, which have a lot of minorities, don't really have much higher vote shares for these ethno-nationalist parties.
On the question of intolerance, to the extent that you could do panels, did you find much? I'm interested about the young people. Mm-hmm. Are they more intolerant or becoming more intolerant? And what, so the discussion of this, I was working in Slovakia in 98 when there was the election of Brits, the Hedgeyard was out. And most of the people I knew were very happy with the results of the election because Hedgeyard was out.
Yeah.
You had this coalition come in. But there was one sort of statistic that was being published in the election results, which I thought was rather concerning, that the SNS, the Slovak Nationalist Party, actually had increased significantly among people under, whatever, 25 or 30, something like that. I wonder if the young people are becoming more intolerant at the same, or are intolerant at the same level as the older generations. Or not? Was that just an aberration in Slovakia, or is such information available?
Well, I mean, the thing that could be done is just, even without a panel, you could look at sort of age distribution of these kinds of things. And to tell you the truth, I haven't done it. The one thing that I do know is that the people who voted for the extreme right tend to be younger. So the if you want to think about it, the nasty young voters vote for the extreme right. The nasty old voters vote for the communists. So there's a little bit of that, which is partly why the sort of the voters for the ex-communists look so bad, is because there's a lot of the sort of old, you know, everybody who's over 60 more or less votes for them. I mean, not everybody, but a large part, and a lot of those people are sort of anti-West and so on. But yeah, I think like I said, I haven't looked at this sort of cross-generational thing. My guess is there's not a whole lot of a difference, and that's definitely a concern. I mean, again, I think that for a lot of these people, they're definitely much more pro-Western, and hopefully, again, the process of going enough times to the West and seeing that it's not really okay to do this. But of course, the problem is that they might be going to the West and finding out that it is okay to say bad things about them. Right? I mean. That's unfortunately the story. Whenever you go to Western Europe, it's the official rhetoric is like, well, we should be nice to minorities and so on. And then the reality of it is that, you know, keep these East Europeans out, keep these Turks out, keep these Arabs out. You know, that jives very well with what East Europeans say about their minorities. So I don't know that it's really going to be a long term solution.
Did you say in your comments that? These countries, Romania and Bulgaria, are expecting a large influx of foreigners into those countries. So what's drawing them in?
No, I don't think yet. But I think that as they get into the EU and so on, I mean, already the Romanians have a fair number of Moldovans who come in, you know. Yeah. So there's a little bit of that. I'm sure the Bulgarians will get, you know, Macedonians, and will get, I mean, that kind of stuff. They're not that exciting yet as markets. I mean, there's still a lot more Romanians and Bulgarians going to Italy and to France than the other way around. But you start seeing there's sort of these small minorities. For example, there's several tens of thousands of people from Hong Kong moved to Eastern Europe. Yeah, right before it was handed over to China, because they wanted to get out, and these were sort of affordable places to go. And you sort of see, even though there are not a lot of them, but there's, you know, the way this sort of gets covered and so on, there's some of those reactions. And, you know, once there are more of them, I think it will be worse.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I think lots of people had to leave to get to go 1:15, 1:20.
Yeah, no, that's, sorry I went so late.
I had one Slovak friend who threatened that may have gone ahead and voted for the Hungarian party, not because of the 98 Slovak, or Hungarian, but just